क्रीडाभन्दम् विश्वम् इदम् यस्य विभूमन् तस्मै नित्यम् नाथ नमः ते करवाम कन्दर्व उच्चुः आं शंशस्ते देवमरिचि अदाय एते Can you chant it? Can you do it once?
Just like Chintamani Prabhu's have faced with a verse like this, I often think of the meter we usually chant, Chintamani Prakara Sadmasu. It fits. That's just a tip. Anyway, this meter is also very nice. Thank you very much. Spasiba.
It does. It's like.
Angsha Chintamani. Ang shang shaste de vemari cha de yete.
Should we have the devotees chant the verse?
Yeah, please. Please chant.
Gandharvah, the Gandharvas, Uchuhu, Seth, Ansha Ansha, parts and parcels of your body, Te, your, Deva, dear Lord, Marichi Adeha, Marichi and the great sages, Ete, these Brahma Indra Adya, headed by Brahma and Indra, Deva Ganaha, the demigods, Rudra Purogaha, having Lord Shiva as the chief, Krida Bhandam, a plaything, Vishwam, the whole creation. Idam, this, yasya, of whom? Vibhuman, the Supreme Almighty Great. Tasmai, unto him. Nityam, always. Natha, O Lord. Namaha, respectful obeisances. Te, unto you. Karavama, we offer. Translation. The Gandharva said, Dear Lord, all the demigods, including Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, Indra, and Marichi, and the great sages, are all only differentiated parts and parcels of your body. You are the supreme, almighty, great. The whole creation is just like a plaything for you. We always accept you as the supreme personality of Godhead, and we offer our respectful obeisances unto you. Purport. In the Brahma Samhita, it is said that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There may be many gods, from Brahma, Lord Shiva, Indra, and Chandra, down to the rulers of the lower planetary systems, the presidents, ministers, chairmen, and kings. In fact, anyone can think that he is God. That is the false, puffed-up conviction of material life. Actually, Vishnu is the Supreme Lord, but there is even one above Vishnu, for Vishnu is also the plenary portion of a part of Krishna. In this verse, this is referred to by the word amsha amshaha, which refers to part and parcel of a part and parcel. There are similar verses in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which indicate that the Supreme Lord's parts and parcels again expand into other parts and parcels. As described in Srimad Bhagavatam, there are many manifestations of Vishnu and many manifestations of living entities. Vishnu manifestations are called Svamsha, partial manifestations, and the living entities are called Vibhinamsha. The demigods like Brahma and Indra have been promoted to such exalted positions by pious activities and austerities, but actually Vishnu or Krishna is the master of everyone. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is said, Ekale Ishvara Krishna Ara Sabha Bhritya. This means that Krishna alone is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and all others, even the Vishnu Tattva and certainly the living entities, are his servitors. Baladev is the immediate expansion of Krishna. He also engages in the service of Krishna, and certainly the ordinary living entities are serving. Everyone is created constitutionally for serving Krishna. Here the Gandharvas acknowledge that although the demigods may represent themselves as the supreme, actually they are not supreme. Real supremacy belongs to Krishna. Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam is the statement of Srimad Bhagavatam. Krishna is the only Supreme Lord. Worship of Krishna alone, therefore, includes worship of all the parts and parcels, just as watering the root of a tree also waters all the branches, twigs, leaves, and flowers.
Srila Prabhupada comments herein, anyone can think that he is God. Bhakti Sean related to me an incident that happened to him recently. He was in a local branch of Trader Joe's store. That's not very interesting. The next bit is more interesting. And some young lady there expressed interest in seeing him in devotional clothes. So they had a little discussion, in course of which, with a beaming smile on her face, she declared to him, I am God. Anyone can think that he is God. Anyone can say that he is God. Under the influence of Mayavad or similar related philosophies, we say philosophy in the conventional sense of the term, which means various mental speculations by which persons of some intellectual capacity attempt to construct thought systems to explain what they perceive. Although actually, that's not real philosophy. Actual philosophy means to understand reality as it is. And what's the difference between constructing a thought system based on our perceptions and understanding reality as it is? What's the difference between speculative philosophy and actual philosophy? Speculative philosophy is, by its nature, doomed to imperfection. One can never understand reality by the process of perception, hypothesizing, and attempting to come to a conclusion. Because of the innate defects of the conditioned soul. For a start, what we perceive through our senses must be imperfect perception. Our perception is limited and tends to mislead us. Plus, that we are in illusion means that our interpretation of what we perceive is also in, that compounds the difficulty. That we have the cheating propensity encourages us, self-deception encourages us to think that we know what's right even when we don't. We become very convinced that what I know is correct. And that we make mistakes, well, we may make even major blunders in, even in the process of making a logic, what we consider to be a logical construct. We may make major mistakes. Just like, for instance, the basis of modern empiric thought, or any empiric thought, whether modern, ancient, or in the future, is to consider that knowledge can only be attained through sensory perception. Or in other words, I only believe it if I see it, or touch it, or taste it, or smell it, or feel it, or hear it. But this, although it may sound very reasonable, is from the very beginning foolish, because on what grounds can we propose that all knowledge must be within the grasp of our sensory perception? Sensory perception, and then on the basis of sensory perception, we extrapolate. This is pratyaksha and anumana. So we extrapolate theories which appear to be reasonable. We presume our interpretation of phenomena to be factual, even though we don't have direct sensual perception of them. For instance, if I'm standing in the temple room, facing towards the deities, and I hear behind me a bell ringing, I will, even without seeing, I will presume that the sound of the bell is this bell here, because that's normally the bell that's rung in this temple room. So, without turning round, to see, I presume someone is ringing the bell. Although I don't have direct... I presume that someone has put their hand up and moved the... What's that part called? Knocker. Moved the knocker and knocked the bell, and therefore there is a sound. Ding! However, it is possible that someone at some point in time made a recording of that sound and has walked into the temple room and is replaying it. It's possible. However, it is reasonable to presume that this is not the case and someone is actually ding, ringing the bell. So that is a reasonable anuman or guess. So that we can accept at a simple level. But when we try to investigate the complexities of the universe, then both our sensory perception and our abilities to or to reasonably present extrapolations or hypotheses based on the sense perceptions becomes more strained. And this is the story of philosophy, or in the modern age, the scientific method, trying to explain phenomena which are actually beyond the scope of human beings to properly explain. What is the nature of reality as tiny, limited beings living in a blip of time on some tiny little somewhere in the middle of what we don't know, although we can gaze out at the stars and try to imagine that we do know, and we may know to some extent, but our ability to perceive the whole big picture is so limited as to be inconsequential. And therefore, although we may arrogate to ourselves the position of philosophers or scientists, we are doomed to a vision that is incomplete at best, almost certainly imperfect. So, the young lady in Trader Joe's, who with great conviction declares, "I am God," is an illusion. Of course, what is the meaning of God? That's another question. We have atheists who say, "I don't believe in God." When people say that, I often say to them, "Well, which God don't you believe in? What's your definition of God?" It's quite likely that the God they don't believe in, we don't believe in either. Or another idea that bubbles up from the frothing lake of eclectic Neo-Mayavad is that God can be defined as you like. You can change your understanding as you go along. This kind of idea means that actually people do consider that I am God. Even to say I believe in God is paradoxically some kind of atheism. To say I believe in God means that it suggests that we consider that God's existence or non-existence is dependent upon my belief. I actually know what's going on, and I believe in God. Dear God, I'd like to let you know that I am allowing you to exist. So be thankful to me, because if you don't do what I say, I might not believe in you, and then you won't exist. So even the statement, Prabhupada, whenever he was asked, well, what do you believe in, or do you believe in, Prabhupada would always say, it is not a question of belief. It is a science. People become confused because they consider that science means, any scientist have any cure for a lost voice? On the spot cure? Yes, scientist Vijay Prabhu has some. Fisherman's friend, is it?
Ayurvedic.
This is Kuntil, something like that. Yeah, I know. I have long experience of using these. Maybe Satan is taking away my voice because he doesn't want me to speak about God. That's another atheistic idea. That there is a competitor to God. That there's someone who God has to, you know, he has to sit down, have a council of angels and think, hey, what are we going to do next? Keep a watch on him. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur suggested that this belief in Satan, a competitor to God, is another kind of latent atheism. So, it is a science. Science, in Prabhupada's pithy definition, is to know things as they are. That is science. And although one may be lauded as a great scientist, if he can only offer theories, then he's not, in the true sense of term, a scientist. A scientist should be able to explain what's going on. Now, if a scientist tells us, or one purported to be a scientist, tells us that combination of hydrogen and oxygen forms dihydrogen oxide, or can form other molecules also. But what is commonly known as water, then that may be considered science. But if they tell us, that could be considered science, because it's easily demonstrable. But if they tell us that, of course, I may not have it down what they say, but Madhavendra Puri can correct me if I get it too much wrong. But that there was, originally there was nothing, which means there was no time either. Then time began with, in the nothingness, a somethingness, which was extremely small, and then it exploded. And it's a long story, but here we are all today. Looking back through history, through the brief history of time, and coming to the conclusion that if we can just find out a theory to explain everything, then that would be the ultimate triumph of man, for we would have understood the mind of God. So, although they don't believe in God, they are ambitious to emulate the mind of God, or to promote themselves to the status of God. the idea that by science we shall understand everything and control everything. However, it's not very difficult to understand that it is not possible for human beings to control everything. This can be understood by a slight consideration of the defecatory process. That, however much one may think he is God, the supreme controller, if he has the runs or diarrhea or dysentery in more scientific language, I'm sure there's an even more obscure term, he can't control it, and it can lead to embarrassing pastimes of the so-called God. Is that he or she is passing stool in his or her pants. So that's not the symptom of God. Another one is that one may want to pass stool and is not able to, and is straining away in his pastimes on the pot. So it doesn't require a very high level of philosophical inquiry to understand that we are not the supreme controller if we cannot even control our defecatory process. But nevertheless, certain persons go to Trader Joe's to get their organic food so they don't get poisoned by the inorganic food. And after handing the money over on the counter for the food which they are purchasing, if they say, "I am God, so patrong pushpang palang toya, you should just offer this to me," they'll say, "Go see the boss, Trader Joe." But they can't even get to see him because he's too big. Even the boss of Trader Joe's, the owner, who's not a very big personality in this world, but bigger than most, probably wouldn't have the time of day to see a young lady who wants to declare to him that, "I am God, and you should offer leaf, flowers, fruit, and water to me with devotion, and I shouldn't have to pay for it because I'm God." So, a little philosophical inquiry, practical philosophical inquiry, will reveal very clearly to anyone who has any sense of rational, organized philosophical inquiry that I am not God, we are not God, we are not the controllers, we are controlled. And that even supposedly scientifically propounded theories, even if propounded by world-famous scientists, highly respected in their fields, who can produce pages and pages of mathematical formulae to supposedly back up their theories, if they say that originally there was nothing and then there was something, using the word singularity, which means a unique event or something that just happens without us being able to explain why, and it just happened, and then it all exploded, because within this singular point of infinitesimal size, there was infinite mass, which doesn't sound very scientific or realistic. And then it exploded into the ordered form of the universe as we see it now. Now, there may be many pages of mathematical formulae to explain this apparent happening. But if we just, without being dazzled by the razzmatazz of scientific bombast, if we just coolly consider that what is the qualification of anyone to say this? How can we say? On what basis can we say what happened billions of years ago? From the position that we are in now, to extrapolate what happened in the distant past, we can only speculate at best. And there may be so many different possible scenarios that if we can apparently explain by presenting mathematical formulae, but nevertheless, it is almost certain to be incorrect. Actually, the Bhagavatam's description, or even for that matter, the Christian creationist description of the origin of the universe. Of course, you may say I'm biased, but to me, it sounds much more plausible that there, because we see the whole universe is so ordered, there would not be any science if there was not order within the universe. Because science means to study the order of the universe. And that it is so ordered, a highly plausible explanation is that some intelligent being with a specific purpose set it all up. To say that it's all come into being without any purpose, and that without any input from any person, everything is going on in such an ordered manner, is far less plausible than the theory that there, if we take it as a theory, that there, everything has been put into order by an orderer under his order. If we see even something very simple, this is, what do you call this? What's it called in American English? A cup on it. A steel cup. I'm just asking because in the Indian English that I know, it's called a steel glass. Although it's not glass. Okay. Madhavendra Puri Prabhu, speaking on behalf of the scientists here. If I told you that I have got detailed scientific, a detailed scientific explanation of how this steel cup came into being by chance. No one designed it. It wasn't got from a shop. There was just, in my back garden, it just appeared. And I have good grounds to suggest that no one put it there. It didn't drop out of a low-flying aircraft. It just appeared by chance, without any cause or reason. What would you think?
They wouldn't say that.
They wouldn't say that. But they say the whole universe comes into being. They wouldn't say a little glass comes into being by chance. They say the whole universe comes into being by chance.
Their idea is that most universes are devoid of variegated properties, but just as in the third canto, chapter 26, is described a series of unfolding elements, in a few universes, if you have a large enough number...
If you have enough.
Yeah, if you have enough universes, and some process generates a huge number of universes, in a few of those universes... There
Wait a minute, you're already skipping. Some process creates the universes, but you're already coming at an intermediate point.
The process by which universes are generated is,
yeah,
is under investigation.
Aha.
That's what they say.
All right. But they basically, it comes down to chance that if you have enough universes, then enough universes generated, then in one of them, the tremendous complexity that we perceive may come about. It's a variation of the, if you have enough monkeys jumping around on typewriters, they'll type out all the works of Shakespeare in due course of time.
That's actually a valid principle, in that if you do have enough monkeys in a long enough time, you will produce any text. The question is how long and how many monkeys are required.
Yeah. So, it's also quite plausible that the mud in my backyard could, at some point in time, just shape, or not even that, this could just appear. I was just sitting gazing at my backyard, and it suddenly appeared.
They wouldn't say that because that's never observed.
Nor is the universe is coming into being observed.
So then they'll say, well, where did God come from? If you postulate God is the origin of everything, then where did God come from?
We discussed this before, didn't we? Last time I was here in L.A. That there is a cause, we're saying there is a cause, an orderer. What we are saying is that the universe has not come into being by chance, but there is an intelligent, capable designer. So they will say, where has God come from? Well, before we go to that question, first of all, if you make the question, where has the intelligent, capable designer come from? Then you have to accept the possibility of there being an intelligent, capable designer. Otherwise, you shouldn't ask that question.
Every reasonable scientist will acknowledge that God could exist.
Yeah, then why they don't?
Well, it's not they. It's not a monolithic group. There's a few highly vocal atheists who are saying various things, but not all scientists agree with them.
All right. Yeah, I know that. But what's generally propagated is that everything has come into being by chance, is it not?
Well, what they would say is, first of all, it's not that things come from nothing. It's that subtler energies produce grosser energies, which is just what we're saying in the third canon, chapter
26. Isn't that what Stephen Hawking, for instance, says?
They're still trying to work out what the ultimate process is whereby gross matter is generated.
Uh-huh. All right.
That's under investigation.
All right, it's under investigation. But what comes out in the popular science books?
That should not be considered because those...
It should be considered because that's what reaches the people in general and what is being propagated. That's what's being put over. That's how misleading is going on in the name of science.
Yeah, that's the
it propaganda. Should certainly be considered.
Yeah, that's the propaganda of a few atheistic vocal persons.
Yeah. And so that's what comes over.
Yeah, that should be cut out. We're trying to challenge that.
Yeah. Me too. Not on your level. Hare Krishna. Any question or more comment?
See, what they would say is if you can either propose God as the origin of everything or some physical process as the origin of everything. In either case, there has to be a leap of faith.
Yeah, definitely. So in everything we do, there's faith.
Yeah, so they would say, or reasonable scientists say, we don't know what the origin of everything is. Maybe it was God, maybe it was a physical process, and we're investigating that.
Yeah.
So that's the position of a reasonable scientist. Mm-hmm. And many scientists feel like that. Then there's a very small, highly vocal atheistic group that's trying to push a particular propaganda. And that, of course, is unjustified. So we're trying to point out that that is unjustified.
They are vocal, aren't they?
And as far as things happening by accident, if suppose you have 10 devotees flipping coins, and you want all 10 to come up heads at the same time, the probability of that is 1 out of 1,000. So if someone says that's impossible, that's not rational to say that, because if you flip a coin on the average hundreds of thousands of times, every 1,000 times you'll expect to see the coins all 10 heads up on one occasion.
What about demonstration by probability theory that life cannot arise from matter?
I talked to Sataputta about that recently. It's not as simple as presented there in the 5th chapter of Mechanistic and Non-Mech, because there are different ways to calculate information content. If you read that chapter carefully, it's based on calculating the information content of the laws of physics and the information content of biological structures and comparing those two.
But the nature of matter is so, it seems, infinitely complex.
Well, the nature of matter is under investigation. The ultimate nature of
matter. Which suggests that it's so highly complex that even all the great scientists in the world, with their accumulation of knowledge to date, still find it under the very nature of what they're studying.
Everyone will agree it's complicated, but I don't see how that supports a theistic theory over an atheistic theory.
That it is so highly... Okay. You speak.
Therefore, the point that Prabhupada always came to is let them both be taught. And that's exactly what's being fought right now in the courts in the United States. There are people who are proposing this ID, this intelligent design. They don't want to say God, but they say at least we see there must be some intelligence out there. And the scientists are fighting even against that.
It's as good a theory.
Yeah, they're saying this is bringing God into the classroom, and that's not science. We want to teach science. We don't want any, so that they're not even gentlemen. That's what Prabhupada always concluded. If you say that you have a theory, and you say that our side is also a theory, then teach both theories. Why select one over the other?
The existence of a personal God fulfills another criteria, that of love and other emotions. That our inherent desire to love and be loved. Now, that could be postulated to be reducible to physical interactions within the brain. But that is not pleasing. That does not satisfy our desire for love or to be loved. So the idea that science has to explain everything in cold terms, that doesn't cover the whole of reality as we observe it or as we experience it. Our need for love and interaction transcends simple examination of matter. That's again a philosophical question, and ultimately it comes down to faith on either side. And there's much, much more books and years of discussion that could go on like this. But I'll finish this class here. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.